This program is brought to you by the Ford Hall Forum at Suffolk University. Please visit us at fordhallforum.org.
This is your part of the program where, as always, with the tradition of the Ford Hall Forum, that we are open and free to the public, and we also give you an opportunity to address the speaker and ask questions. Now, you should know that this is being recorded for the WGBH Forum Network, and by asking a question, then you are giving us permission to record you. And as the moderator, I'm going to take my opportunity to ask questions first, and then you can start thinking about what you'd like to ask Cecile. In the mid-80s, we in Massachusetts had a ballot question. Now, not all states have ballot access for questions that people can petition, and there was one on the ballot in Massachusetts that would make it very difficult to get an abortion. So there were many, many people who were active in that campaign, and I was one of them. And I would get calls at my home, and I had young children at the time, from people who would say obscene things to whoever answered the phone, pretty obscene and nasty. And I know that one of the things that people have talked about is that, or felt, is that the opposition that you talked about comes from a very different place than the kind of family planning beliefs that you have. So I'm wondering if you could comment about that and what it's like today out there in the land. I just read, I think, on one of the emails that comes from you frequently about the targeting family planning clinics in Georgia and Colorado, and kind of what it looks like out there.
Sure. So I think it's a good question, and I mean, I think that, you know, I think as long as there should be open conversation and open debate about these issues, and I don't think I want to be clear, I think that's important, that these are issues that are important for us to discuss. But I think the tactics of sometimes that are frankly they're not effective, and I think that they're largely inappropriate. I'm going to give you an example. It's a story I was going to tell, but I was afraid my speech was too long. But after we actually opened our clinic in Aurora, we had a lot of the folks that left there came down to Denver, Colorado, where we were opening a big new health center in outside Denver, and instead of just harassing our staff, which our staff are used to, or being at our clinic, they started following home the construction crews that are building the site. They took their license plates down. They'd go and picket them at their homes. One of the men has been picketed every weekend for months now. He and his wife and his teenage daughter have just gotten used to Saturday, Sunday, big, ugly protests outside their household. One guy, you know, and also they make phone calls to folks' families. And in fact, one of the guys, they called his mom at a nursing home. What happened there? I mean, I think it's tactics that I think any of us would say sort of go above and beyond. Saturday, Sunday, gotten used to. His daughter of just beyond go above and they sort of said. I think any of us would say it's tactics there. And I went out and had pizza with them the other day. The guys that were on the crew and the women that were on the crew, and you know, as far as they were concerned, this was their job, and they were there to build a healthcare center, and they were going to do it. And the irony is, we're going to finish that center 2 months early because these guys are ready to get finished on this job. And so as opposed to a tactic like that actually delaying construction, in fact, it's sped it up. So I always sort of think of there are ways in which we make lemonade out of the lemons that are thrown us. But I do think I think that in this country, as I look around, because we have very ugly pickets and protests, when you talk to folks about what they feel about it, regardless of their personal feeling about abortion, about family planning, one of the things you hear consistently is folks hate to see people picketing women and harassing women who are trying to go get health care in clinics. And that's across the board, regardless of geography, regardless of party. I think there's a certain civility that people in this country expect, and I don't think it behooves anyone to go after women who oftentimes are just going for health care that they need. We'll see. I think the tactics change. You know, obviously gagging is no longer the fashion as it was in Margaret's day. But I think at the end of the day, the tactics that are used generally end up making us stronger. And I think bringing folks to our side. One of the interesting things about the Colorado example is, you know, the men in particular who've been the subject of the ugliest picketing and attacks have become such strong Planned Parenthood advocates and supporters, guys who never really were involved in the movement in any way, but who now actually go and speak to other businesses and other folks in the community to talk about how important it is to support women's health. So some good news out there.
Thank you. And the microphone's up here if you want to get up in line. Don't be afraid. Yes. First question.
I want to condemn the introduction, that part of the introduction which tried to link David Duke, of all people, with the pro-life movement, not anti-choice, another hit term we heard from the introduction. It's pro-life. So your bias is showing right there.
Oh, I am biased.
And now the irony, of course, is that Margaret Sanger herself was in bed, figuratively speaking, with Ku Kluxers and Nazis and in her campaign for her causes, as our speaker knows. I'd like to ask our speaker about Margaret Sanger, and she has a long paper trail, of course. We know what she said about any number of topics, really repugnant things, not confined to eugenics, but other matters, other of her language, her condemnation of certain groups, of even of sexual practices which she denounced, which you obviously would, and most of us would accept as okay today. And bizarrely enough, in her autobiography, she did admit that abortion is the taking of life at any stage, something you, I think, would want to distance yourself from. Finally, I'd like to ask you about this bizarre practice of sex selection abortion, which is taking place in certain Asian countries, and now, according to recent reports that I have seen, is coming over here to the United States. We have certain Asians in this country who are practicing sex selection abortion. Now, what's that all about?
Okay.
We have
those are two fair questions.
Determination of the sex of the developing child, and of course among those Asian families, females are less desired. So we have a disproportionate amount of female babies being flushed down the toilet. That okay with you as a form of abortion?
Cecile, would you want to answer the Margaret Sanger question and then the one about sex selection?
Right. So I don't think it was like one direct Margaret Sanger question, but in any case, I mean, Margaret Sanger was a complex leader, and I can't begin to know all of the things that Margaret Sanger, believed. What she did stand for and what Planned Parenthood stands for is the right of women to determine the size of their families. And that was what she fought for, and that's what Planned Parenthood stands for today, and will continue to do so. I think that it's a fundamental human right for women to be able to determine when and whether to have children. And I think that's what Planned Parenthood's mission is, and what we believe in. And we also believe that should be available to women regardless of their economic situation and anything else. Clearly, no one supports sex selection as a means of determining your family, and we would never support that, never have.
Thank you. Next questioner.
Hi, my name is Garrett Peterson.
Hey, Gary.
Cecile, despite their complaints about judicial activism, the anti-abortion movement is continuing to pursue, and I think hopes to overturn Roe through the courts rather than the national legislative process, mm-hmm. which amounts to a gag on the electorate. With the fate of Roe turning on only one vote in the Supreme Court, right. Are you going to have to wait for them to actually succeed and then mount a national legislative campaign to legalize abortion and other reproductive health rights? Or is there something that we as the electorate can do to influence the court's decision?
Right. So it's a good question, Gary. I mean, I think some folks believe that the movement writ large has sort of depended exclusively on the Supreme Court to protect women's rights for perhaps too long. And that I think that, as we've seen over the years, that even though the right to a legal abortion is still protected, it's become it's become undermined in many ways by legislation at the state level. So increasingly, Planned Parenthood works at the state level to expand healthcare access and availability on a whole host of issues, not only abortion. And I think that's important that we do that. I also believe that the federal judiciary is a reflection many times of where the American people are. And I think this is what's, obviously, the election is going to have a huge impact, I think, on how people see where the American people think we want to be. And poll after poll after poll will tell you in the electorate, people do not want to go back to a time in which women died. And they would, and they do in foreign countries now. Maternal mortality because of botched abortions, because of lack of access to abortions, is a serious, serious issue. And I think that that's the issue we really need to be putting before the American people. And the most important thing, too, I think we can do to pull people together, and I sort of began to reference that when I was speaking, is that I think what there is huge unanimity in this country is we could be doing an enormous amount to preventing unintended pregnancy in this country. It's unacceptable that half of the pregnancies in this country are unintended. And it's directly related to lack of access to healthcare and lack of access to information. So if every woman in this country, you know, had access to the information and the healthcare that she needed, we could do a lot. We could do a lot to reduce the need for abortion, frankly, unintended pregnancy overall. But you're right, we can't, I don't think the strategy can any longer be to simply hope that the courts protect us, because it's simply not going to happen, you know. Thanks. Thank you.
My name is Bob Wiener.
Hi, Bob.
There is a curious, almost kind of cyclical set of events, the gagging of Margaret Sanger and the abstinence-only program, the Scopes trial, which was 25, Margaret Sanger was 29.
Right.
And the attack on Darwinism today through these nutty, the discovery group and so forth. In the 1920s and today, it was the same, in a sense, the same group of people motivating these attacks. Now, things changed, I think, with the Depression, and because of it, people had more important things to think about.
Right.
Are we going to have to go through something as traumatic as a depression to shut these people up?
Okay, Bob. You've been doing some thinking. Look, I think what we're seeing in this, we're always going to have these arguments and discussions in this country, forever. What I think we're seeing in this country is actually a swing really away from this very doctrinal assault on whether it's on women's health and rights, whether it's on civil rights, a whole host of issues. I feel very encouraged. I think that. And I guess I see it partly, I see it in young people today. This is a country that I think that this next generation coming up is, they're more open on a lot of issues. They are more open racially. They're more open to people of different sexual orientations. They think of the world in a global sense, not simply of the place that they sit. And I feel like we're moving into a more enlightened period. That's the hopeful side of me. And I think what we're seeing, I really believe, in the last 8 years, 10 years, where particularly the politics of division in this country have been so severe. It's been very much a us versus them kind of mentality. And I think the American people are saying that's not who we want to be. That's not how we want our government to be, and that's not who we are as a people. So, I mean, I just think we see all kinds of encouraging signs around there. And again, it's sort of ironic, almost to Gary's point, I see sort of, I think the most lasting lasting impact that this administration may make, besides the impact globally and the view of the United States that I think has taken such a beating, is in the remaking of the federal judiciary, and that's going to have a lasting consequence long after it's relevant. Because I think the Supreme Court is out of step with where the American people are, and I think the federal judiciary is as well. So those are things we're going to have to deal with, even as I see this country moving in a much more progressive and encouraging direction.
I wish I could share your enthusiasm.
Come on the road with me. I'll introduce you to some of these young folks. I mean, I think it's impossible to not be, if you are a progressive in this country, if you're an organizer, it's impossible to see what's been happening in the last 12 to 18 months in this country and not feel hopeful. And not feel that there is a kind of engagement and enthusiasm, and particularly of the next generation, about what this country could be, that's infectious. So I think this next several months is going to be very interesting, but I'm really encouraged, so.
Let's hope so.
Yes, let's do.
Could you elaborate a little bit? You've mentioned the federal judiciary a couple of times. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by that and what... Exactly what are you talking about in their effect?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the Supreme Court is one where I think, again, we've got obviously our decision was a shot across the bow in terms of what I think it's going to mean for women's health. And even without a change in this, without a change in the current makeup of the court, I think a willingness to really look at restricting women's health care access and protection of women's health care. But across the board, I mean, there has been, you know, in the last 8 years, this administration has made appointments to the circuit courts that are lifetime appointments and have really made it. If you are a progressive, if you work in the areas of civil liberties and women's rights and women's health rights, the federal judiciary in general is not a good place to go for redress. And that's going to be for a very long time, I fear.
I think part of the confusing thing is that in different states, the courts are treated differently. In some places, they're elected and in some places, their appointments, and the federal judiciary is appointed by the federal government.
Appointed so by the federal government.
And, so it's who and the president is.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
The president has a lot of power, just to remind you about that.
Right.
Yes, next question, please. And don't forget, line up here for your questions.
This is a little difficult for me. I usually, because I have to speak extemporaneously, and I'm not good at that, but I will. I was at an Amy Goodman lecture a week ago, and after the lecture ended, I just said something like this, André Chénier, la créativité belle comme le mois de mai. And...
Could you translate that for us?
Creativity, beautiful like the month of May. After I finished that, I felt very alone, and yet at the same time, I had a sense of power that all these other people, this is true actually, that all these other people were sitting down and I was standing up. Mm-hmm. Standing up, that's the word she used, you know, and I want to just speak about, you said that the apathy, you know, if we're apathetic, that's not good.
And you have a question for Cecile?
In my own heart, you know, on some, say, civil rights issues, like these issues too, mm-hmm. I feel divided between my mind and my heart. Mm-hmm. My mind says, well, I should, regarding apathy, I should speak out on this. And my heart says, well, maybe you
right.
be a couch
okay.
potato.
Would you like Cecile to respond to that?
Would you have any advice?
Yeah. No, well, I think the important thing about taking action is it's when you take action communally to make change, I think it's a very, it's invigorating, it's and it gets you outside of yourself. And so I think that the more you can think of yourself in a community and what that community cares about and link arms with other people on issues you care about, I think it reduces apathy and it gives people a sense of power and courage and that I think can carry you forward. So
get good practice at it.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. Thanks so much. Thanks.
Next, thank you.
Hi, my name is Ellen Reardon.
Hi.
I have a question. You said that this teaching of abstinence is 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that get passed?
So is it Ellen?
It is, yes.
Yeah. It actually started under Clinton as a small program, and then what's happened in the last 8 years is it's grown phenomenal, you know.
So it was under Clinton?
Began, yeah.
It began it,
yeah, in a small way, sort of as a small program, and then it's just continued to grow. And just honestly, as with other sometimes federal programs, once it began to grow and there was more money in it, a whole industry sort of has been created, an abstinence-only curriculum and programs and groups that get funded from the federal government to do abstinence-only. They now have their own lobby in Congress to lobby for continued abstinence-only programming. And despite all of the studies, both independent in Congress's own review of the program that showed makes absolutely no impact, it's very hard to end federal programs. And that's why we've really focused on the states to say, we just need states to continue now to say, this is a program that doesn't work for us, and we're not gonna take any more money out of this program. Instead, we're gonna redirect our resources of the state to what we think of as important, which is abstinence-based but comprehensive sex education for young people.
I have just another question.
Sure.
Could a newly elected president have any power over this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, it's really been at the, I mean, Congress obviously passes the budget, but it has been a very strongly pushed program by the administration. And so having an advocate in the White House who believes we need to actually be doing right by our kids, what I think we need to be doing, which is teaching them, giving them information they need, I think you have a sympathetic Congress, and I think we could really redirect valuable resources into really doing comprehensive sex education. I think that all of us, I'm a parent of three teenagers, right? We all want to think that our kids are going to delay having sex until they're married, and you know, until they're, you know, completely ready. But I think what we have got to get real about in this country is that young people are having sex. They did back in the 50s, you know, they have forever. And the best thing we can do is have an open dialogue with them, make sure they have information. And what kids say consistently, which is totally counterintuitive, is that they wish their parents would talk to them about sex, about relationships, give them an opening so that they could have an open conversation with somebody. And when they can't talk to a parent, have somewhere they can go, whether it's a Planned Parenthood or it's a trusted, you know, adult at their school, someone who they can actually come to with questions and information, because they need a place to go. And right now, I think we're really failing them. I think we can't expect our kids to be responsible if we're not willing to take responsibility for giving them the information and support that they need. So
I just thought of something else. Electing Hillary Clinton, I wonder if she would carry on that program of her husband's.
You know,
just a joke.
I mean, no, I understand. Well, but I will say, we'll take that opening just to say that frankly, Senator Clinton and Senator Obama both have been strong supporters of getting comprehensive sex education back in schools and providing information for young people.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. As a follow-up about the federal budget, the president introduces the budget to Congress, and then they have to respond to it. So if the president puts out a budget that defunds or unfunds or minimizes a program, the Congress would have to respond to that. And keep in mind that the new president, even though he or she will come in January, they're going to be living under this president's budget until October of next year. But you can look at the budget that they present in next March or next year and see whether, you know, where that is.
Right.
And maybe Cecile will comment on, you commented on Hillary and Barack. What about McCain?
Senator McCain has not a great track record on issues that Planned Parenthood works on. In fact, he has a 0% voting record.
That would be pretty low.
A zero. It's really
that would be low.
We really couldn't find a number lower than zero.
Right.
And And I think, which is interesting because it's sort of counterintuitive, I think, to how some voters think of him as being more of a maverick. But when it comes to issues such as, you know, birth control being covered by insurance programs, getting comprehensive sex education in schools, those kinds of things, he's not been supportive. And, you know, we'll see how this election turns out. I mean, how I think it shapes up in terms of the debate. But so far, he doesn't have a good record, at least from Planned Parenthood's point of view on these issues. And I think it's pretty out of touch on women's health issues in general.
Before we go to the next question, I want to pick up one thing you said just so I don't forget. You talked about birth control not being covered by health insurance in some places, some health insurance,
right.
And does it cover Viagra?
Well, of course, a lot of them, almost all of them cover Viagra. Yeah.
And it's generally available
right.
If you have a prescription.
Correct.
I just
no, exactly. No, it's a point that's always good to make. One other thing I'll just mention, that because it is a really important issue that we've been working on this year, which is under the last Congress, before the Democrats took control of the Congress, Congress ended a program that allowed college campuses and other safety net providers from getting affordable birth control. And I don't even know that it was intentional, but we've been working ever since then to try to redress it. So if any of you have daughters on college campuses, not that they're having sex, but just in case they are.
They're not. It's just...
I know they're not, but some of their friends might be.
Their friends might
be. But, I mean, literally, the cost of birth control went on college campuses from as little as $5 a month to $50 a month. And I think so we've been working very hard. We actually just brought a number of college students to Congress to meet with Senator Reid and other members of the Senate, because it's something we've got to get fixed. I mean, this is... Particularly when you see that teen pregnancy rates are going up, teen birth rates are going up, we still have the highest rate of Western industrialized world. We can't do anything more to make it more difficult for young women to do the responsible thing if they're sexually active, which is to use birth control until they're ready to be a parent. So I encourage anyone who hasn't weighed in on this issue to do so, because it's really important. It affects 3 million college women every year.
So. Sorry to keep you waiting,
no,
sir.
Yeah, at my age, it's a problem.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I got involved in this in 1962 when my then wife went to work as a counselor at one of your clinics in Chicago. And the train she rode into town originated its run in Aurora. My question is, what have you done to influence the people who are your genuine opponents, not the demonstrators in front of your clinics or the assassin in New York that killed the doctor, but the state and the national legislatures, where you, as we elect presidents and get, as we call it, special interest legislation passed, you single out the people that are absolutely against you and ignore them, and you go to work for the others. How is that prosecuted? How do you do that? Mm-hmm. Do you have staff that does that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a great question. I didn't get your name, I'm sorry, but what's your name?
Jack.
Okay. Thank you, Jack. No, it's a wonderful question. I mean, I think really, our major focus at Planned Parenthood is on prevention. That's what we do in terms of our public policy work. It's okay. We could do more to prevent unintended pregnancies, prevent the need for abortion, prevent sexually transmitted infections, do all the kind of work that we need to do. We could take care of a lot of the problems that we spend too much time arguing about in this country. So it is really important to us to reach across the aisle in every way, particularly with legislatures and at the federal level. And I have found that there is an enormous openness by elected officials, those who aren't just really ideologically so hard right, to find ways to come together to solve problems. And this affordable birth control issue is one, in fact, that it's been a great opportunity to sort of really bridge the gap with members of Congress who might call themselves pro-life, but who fundamentally support women's right to family planning and birth control. And I think it's developed relationships that we need to have to solve these problems. And again, I really do feel like that we're moving in this direction in this country. It's interesting, if you poll the American voter and ask them, what do they want the government to do on this whole set of issues, unintended pregnancies, family planning, abortion, sex education. The truth is the American voters, they don't want to talk about abortion anymore. As far as they're concerned, it's legal, it's established. They want to get at the root of the problem, which in this country is we've got too many women that are getting pregnant that aren't ready to have a child or it's an unintended pregnancy. Too many young people that don't have the information they need to stay healthy and safe. And healthcare is not affordable, you know, in this country. And that's what they want the government to focus on. And so I just feel like there's huge opportunities here for us to work, whether it's across party aisles, across ideological aisles, geography, to really address those problems. And if we do, the American people would be happy and they would reelect those elected officials, you know?
Existing apathy in the electorate, which does not move legislatures.
Would you repeat the question, Cecile, so I can get it?
So your point is that there's an existing apathy among the American people.
What
they're tired of is the rancor. What they want to see is elected officials addressing problems and making progress. And look, that's where we are. I would love to not be arguing over all these issues, and let's just focus on the issues that we know we can work on. We know, look, here's, I love this. This is one of my favorite statistics. The average woman in America who wants to have children wants to have an average of 2 children, and she spends an average of 5 years conceiving and having those children. She spends an average of 30 years trying to avoid getting pregnant, okay? So that's 30 years times 60 million women. That's a lot of work to do. And if we could really help women with that, we would be doing enormous amount of good for the American people and for American families. So that's my proposal. Let's come together and do something around that. And I think more and more legislators are going that direction, understanding that, you know, enough of the rancor. Let's get to solving problems. That's my hope.
Next question.
Hi.
Hi.
So it sounds like you're very hopeful about some of the progress Planned Parenthood has made in education, these health services.
Right.
And I was wondering if you see any possibility of the pendulum swinging too far. I think some of the opponents see perhaps problems of distributing condoms, say, to third graders. You know, the moral hazard in that, what message that sends. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the principles and the lines that you draw to think about these issues.
Mm-hmm. And you are?
Oh, and I'm Alex Minier.
Alex is in charge here, guys. He's an important guy.
He's the head of the forum.
Well, look, I think, we have so far to go that I'm not at all worried about swinging too far, to be honest. And I think, you know, actually there was a very interesting case. Some of you all may have read this fall about a school district in Maine where they were dealing with enormously high teen pregnancy rate in the schools, and which was hugely alarming. It's alarming for any parent. And the discussion really was around whether the school should distribute birth control. And the parents in that community and the community leaders decided that they felt like the school should, because there were kids who weren't getting information that they needed to avoid getting pregnant. And that's a community issue. And to me, that's what should lead us in these. I think too often what happens, and look, we all know this, we've all been involved in, anyone who's dealt with school district politics, all it takes is one parent complaining, you know, and the school doesn't want to be anywhere near it. And I think, unfortunately, our policy around really hard issues, right? These are tough issues. No one wants to think about young people having sex at too early an age, or certainly their own kids having sex, and they definitely don't want to think about young people getting pregnant before they're ready to be parents. So these are tough issues. But I think when communities come together and talk about it as a community, make decisions, they make good decisions. I think what happens is, it's the squeaky wheel syndrome, as I think that schools are so concerned about that one complaint and that one parent that they just sort of shut it all down. We have found it's incredible. I work with teenagers all across America who are active with Planned Parenthood, and they really are these amazingly great sort of face of what is really going on for teens in this country. Because the truth is, folks, it's not like it was when we grew up, you know? I mean, Dick Van Dyke or whatever other example you want to use, kids are dealing with a lot of tough issues. I mean, there's just a lot more information. There's a lot more coming at them. And I think we have to listen to our kids. And we have to listen to our kids when they tell us what they need and what they need to be healthy and to be safe and to have good relationships and to navigate a really changing world. So I don't worry. I don't worry about us swinging too far, because I think as a country we're smart and we won't do that. I worry about us, unfortunately, sort of letting a very small vocal minority dictate public policy in this country in a way that damages, you know, another generation of young people.
I'm kind of surprised to hear you say how many young people you work with, mm-hmm. since I hear so often that young women in particular just assume that it's the law of the land and has been forever, because since they've grown up, it's the law of the land. Mm-hmm. And so they think it has always been that way. And that they don't believe that it's, I believe that the apathy part is for so many people who think it's always going to be that way. And I know you gave us the real truth,
right.
But what about all those other folks who aren't as active in Planned Parenthood and other groups? And how do we let them know without scaring them that you know, they're just one person away from changing the law for the whole country?
Well, I think, look, as an organizer, I think you got to meet people where they are. And I do. I go to a lot of meetings where folks say, well, young people today, they don't really know what we went through. They don't know the struggles we went through. And it's true, they don't. And the truth is, they don't want to hear their parents talk about the struggles they went through. They want you to talk about what's going on with them, right? And so I'll tell you two examples I've used already. But when a young woman on campus who was paying $5 for a birth control is now paying $50, like, that's an issue she gets. I don't
so
even
they
have
never
to,
should have made that rule. They
no,
should
it's
never
just amazing. But I mean, so we've had this, literally thousands of young people get involved in this birth control campaign, because for them, like, this is an issue that's relevant to their lives. And when I talk about, you know, I use the example of my friend from Arizona, but young people, I was in Utah the other night for a Planned Parenthood dinner, and we honored a group of young people, a young Latina group that had started in their junior high, and they had started on their own because too many of their peers were getting pregnant, right? They saw it. They see what's happening, and they come to us and say, we want you to work with us and help us, because we got to turn this around. And so to me, it's like we've got to listen to where people are. And I think with young people, they are passionate, and we got to give them room to lead. And it ain't going to be our movement. It's going to be their movement. And as organizers, I think we have to be willing to recognize that Planned Parenthood's been, you know, done this work for the last 91 years. The next 91 years are going to look differently, and we're going to give these young people the room to make it theirs.
And you may not be able to answer this question because it's about Massachusetts, but we have somebody in the audience
right.
who probably could. Would you call our legislature amenable to choice issues from your point of view?
Well, one thing I do want to brag on Massachusetts, even though I'm not from here, but my husband is, so I feel like I'm sort of like, and I'm a big Red Sox fan, so I don't know how much that gets me with you guys, but Massachusetts just passed and signed by Governor Patrick the most progressive buffer law in the entire country.
Explain what a buffer law is.
A buffer law says protects women's access to healthcare institutions without being harassed and you know, all the things that happened to them. It just passed this session and was signed by Governor Patrick. I think it's a 50-foot buffer law. And it means women can go to clinics in Massachusetts and not run the gauntlet that they have to in many other states. So that's unbelievably progressive, and I hope sets sort of a bar for how we like women to be able to get health care in this country. And I also, I already bragged on the governor for the rejection of abstinence-only funding for the state. So, I mean, actually, you all, you're doing very well. My own home state of Texas, we got some work to do. So there's, you know, a wide gulf in this country but, you know, it's interesting. Even Texas, I'll say even Texas because I'm a Texan. Even Texas, their teen pregnancy rate is going up. Their teen birth rate is going up. The Dallas Morning News editorialized this year saying, we've got to look at this absence-only program. It's not working. We've got to do something better for young people. So, I mean, I really think common sense is beginning to, it's beginning to get through, even in some tough states, you know.
The electoral cycle helps.
Absolutely. That's right.
The electoral cycle does help. It also helps if everybody is registered to vote. I hope you all are. And every young person you know should be registered to vote as well and to know when the election is.
Right.
Because there's not just an election in November. There are primaries here in September and all over the country. So everybody has to be aware of that.
Right.
I want to thank Cecile for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Susan.
And
nice
for
to see you.
Bringing Margaret Sanger back to us.
I can't wait to go back and see her in
her alter ego and in the present form. And I would thank you all for coming and hope to see you next week.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan.
This program was brought to you by the Ford Hall Forum at Suffolk University. Please visit us at fordhallforum.org.